Prem Shri Gaur Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadhar Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Jai Shri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shandakunda Radha Kunda Giri Gauradhana Ki Jai. Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai. Mathura Dhamma Ki Jai. Navadri Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai. Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai. Ganga Maya Jamuna Devi Ki Jai. Bhakti Devi Ki Jai. Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai. Samaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada and Ma'am Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Vipinalami. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Vachani Namaste Sasana Homa Vaskati Ayasatana. Mandayam Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Sri Sri Rupam Sagraja Tam Sahagana Raghunatham Vipam Sami Sajiva. Sadvaitam, Sadvaditam, Padijana, Sahita, Krishna, Chaitanya, Devi, Shri Radha, Krishna, Pranam, Sahagana, Vita, Shri, Vishakam, Vita, Shri, Panchakam, Shri, Vishakam, Vita, 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 Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
August 2nd, 2016, in Ljubljana, Slovenia, reading from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 16, Divine and Demoniac Natures, text 10. Kamam ashritya duspuram.
Kamam ashritya duspuram.
Dambamana madanvita.
Dambamana madanvita.
Lohad grihit vasad grahan.
Lohad grihit vasad grahan.
Pravartante suchivrita.
Pravartante suchivrita.
Lust. Ashritya, taking shelter of,
Duspuram,
insatiable, Dumba, of pride, Mana, and false prestige, Mana Anvitaha,
absorbed in the conceit,
Mohat, by illusion,
Grihitva,
taking. Asat,
non-permanent,
Grahan, things, Pravartante, they flourish, Ashuchi, to the unclean, Vrata, avowed. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Taking shelter of insatiable lust and absorbed in the conceit of pride and false prestige, the demoniac, thus illusioned, are always sworn to unclean work attracted by the impermanent. If you look at the Sanskrit, this is really an extraordinary verse. This is the first two words. Kaman ashritya, which means what?
Taking
shelter of lust. Yeah. Purport. The demoniac mentality is described here. The demons have no satiation for their lust. They will go on increasing and increasing their insatiable desires for material enjoyment. Everybody understand what insatiable means? Everybody understand that English word? No? Okay. To be satiated is to be full. Like if a cloth is satiated with water, it can't hold any more water. So they have no satiation. Although they are always full of anxieties on account of accepting non-permanent things, they still continue to engage in such activities out of illusion. So if the things you have are not permanent, you're always going to be in anxiety about when you're going to lose them, right? They have no knowledge and cannot tell that they are heading the wrong way. Accepting non-permanent things, such demoniac people create their own god, create their own hymns, and chant accordingly. You know that's even true in Christianity. Do you know that all the hymns and rituals of Christianity were just made up? Do you all know that? Yes? Does everybody know that? Where do you think they came from?
The Pope.
Well, that actually, what happened was, right, because Jesus was preaching within Judaism, yes? He wasn't starting his own religion. And then his grand disciple, Paul, decided that he was going to preach to non-Jews, and they didn't want to follow the Jewish rituals. They wanted to follow Jesus, but they didn't want to follow the Jewish rituals. So about 100 years after Christ had left the planet, there was this group of Christians who weren't associated with the religion that Jesus had come from. But they wanted something. They wanted rituals and they wanted prayers. And you okay? So they made them up. The result is that they become more and more attached to two things, sex, enjoyment, and accumulation of material wealth. The word ashuchi vrataha, unclean vows, is very significant in this connection. Such demoniac people are only attracted by wine, women, gambling, and meat eating. Those are their asuchi, unclean habits. Induced by pride and false prestige, they create some principles of religion which are not approved by the Vedic injunctions. Although such demoniac people are most abominable in the world, by artificial means, the world creates a false honor for them. Although they are gliding towards hell, they consider themselves very much advanced. Kamam ashrichiduskuram tambamana madan vitaha lohan grihit visadgrahan pravartante shuchi vritaha. Taking shelter of insatiable lust and absorbed in the conceit of pride and false prestige, the demoniac, thus illusioned, are always sworn to unclean work attracted by the impermanent. So Krishna said way back in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita that all of us have a problem with lust. Now, lust here doesn't just mean sexual lust. It means any strong desire for something that is not spiritual. Any strong materialistic desire. And Prabhupada, in this purport, twice talks about non-permanent things, which could make us think that materialism simply means having a lot of things. But it really means a mentality of, I am the Lord, I am the Master. We talked about this a little bit this morning. And Krishna identified that this insatiable urge to be the Lord and to be the Master, that it resides in our body, in our senses, in our mind, and in our intelligence. And it does something very peculiar to us. It makes us do things that we know are wrong. Right? Arjuna asked this question. We're going to be talking about this when we study Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha. But Arjuna asked this question. What was this question in the third chapter? Anybody know? It's a very important question.
He's asking, why is he forced to do...
Why is he forced to do things that are wrong? Do we have this experience? That we feel like a victim? Do we have this experience? We feel like, well, I want to be a good person. You know, I wake up in the morning saying, I want to be a good person. I want to treat people nicely. I don't think there's very many human beings who wake up in the morning and say, I really want to be mean to people. I don't think that that's a fact. Few, but not many. You know, it's not like the person who's rude to you at the shop or something said, I want to be a rude person. It's generally not. We say, I want to control my speech, I want to control my eating, I want to control how I deal with other people, I want to use my time appropriately. Don't we want this? But do we always achieve it? No. I mean, I think we're lucky if a whole day goes by and we really do what we wanted to do. I mean, how many days are there where when we go to sleep at night we say, yes, I completely and totally used this day the way I wanted to, and I acted exactly the way I wanted to all day? Does this happen regularly for us? It's a problem, isn't it? Is this a problem? It's very frustrating, and I think it causes us to have a lot of self-hatred. Even. You know, we say, okay, I want to use my time like this, I want to be this kind of a person, and then we just fail over and over and over again. And it feels like something is forcing us to fail. It feels like, you know, I want to behave in a certain way. I want to do things in a certain way. And something is pushing against my will, my desire, and making me do something else. Do we all have this experience? And I think especially with something like anger, which the Bhagavatam says falls out of the sky. Right? And all of a sudden you're just boom, angry, and then you're embarrassed. And why would I get so angry about that? And when Arjuna asks Krishna, why does this happen? Why do I keep doing and saying and thinking things that I really don't want to do and say and think? And Krishna's answer was, it's lust. Which when I first read that answer when I was 17, I was very disappointed. You know, I was hoping it was going to be some monster in the room that, you know, was taking over me or something, and that I was just a poor little victim. But what's fascinating here is that Krishna says that we intentionally take shelter of this lust. And I just find this completely fascinating. Why would we take shelter of the very thing that is pushing us to do what we don't want to do? Isn't that strange? It's pretty strange. Huh? Now, and we can see this at work in extreme situations if people are addicted to some sort of intoxicant, for example, where they take shelter of the intoxicant, and then the intoxicant pushes them to do things that are against their principles and that they regret while they're doing them and after they're doing them. Am I correct? Is that correct? But you know what? All our material desires are just like that. They're just like some sort of an intoxicant. We were reading this morning, we didn't talk about it much this morning, but Prabhupada said in the purport that the soul is in a deep slumber. So one devotee just asked me this yesterday. And he was saying, to what extent is the soul awake? And if the soul's not awake, then who's deciding things? And I said, well, it's like the soul is very intoxicated. You know, Prabhupada says deep slumber. When I think of deep slumber, it's hard to think of it having any agency at all. But when a person's intoxicated, they still have agency. But they're, you understand what I mean by agency? They have the ability to act and they have responsibility for their actions. So if somebody commits a crime under the influence of some intoxicant, they're still held responsible for that crime. I used to take my secondary students to the courthouse as part of their classes on civics. And we would see that the majority of the crimes were committed under the influence of some sort of intoxicant, alcohol or cocaine or something. So the person intentionally, knowingly takes that intoxicant, generally speaking. People are not forced against their will to take an intoxicant. But then the intoxicant influences them in such a way that they do things that at the time they don't like what they're doing. And after the intoxicant wears off, they feel very ashamed. And this is exactly our position. Each of the modes of nature is like a kind of intoxicant. Or you could say that the modes are various degrees of intoxication, that ignorance is a very deep degree, and passion in the middle, and goodness very light. But they're also a kind of intoxicant, just like among chemical intoxicants, you know, there's there's like uppers and downers, right? There's some intoxicants that make people very hyper, and there's some intoxicants that make people very sleepy, and some intoxicants that make people hallucinate and things like that. So the modes are also different kinds of intoxicants. But they all basically cover our consciousness so that we're no longer aware of our identity, we're no longer aware of what's good and what's bad. And we end up living lives that are more or less composed of things that we regret, that we lament, and we say, why did I do this? Why did I spend my time like this? Why was I this kind of a person? And yet, we intentionally take shelter in them. So the symptoms, Prabhupada talks about in this purport, the symptoms of having this problem, of having taken shelter of this lust. And the symptoms are to always be full of anxieties, to have a lot of fears and anxieties. Accepting non-permanent things. So, counting on non-permanent things for our happiness. Not knowing where we're going. Creating our own process of religion. Getting more and more attached to sex and money. And particularly he's talking about engaging in breaking the four regular principles. But maybe getting some false honor by the world. I really like this idea. Prabhupada talks about asuchi as unclean habits. But I really like the original Sanskrit, asuchi vrata, unclean vows. That people also create their own vows. They become, you know, dedicated. Now, we're going to give food to all the starving people in Africa, but they're giving them meat. You understand? Now they become very determined. They take a great vow to do something, but the thing they take a vow to do is unclean. The thing they take a vow to do is nasty. You know, or we're going to bring birth control and abortion to all the people in India, or things like that. You know, so they take these vows, they get into these charities, but it's all very unclean. So these are some of the symptoms. Now, of course, we as devotees of Krishna or aspiring to be devotees of Krishna, so we certainly are not guilty, hopefully, of most of the things that are mentioned in this purport. Although we do have to be careful because we are involved very much with the outside world. We're a preaching movement. We're always bringing people in from the outside world. So we do get influenced by the outside world, even if we're not so aware of it. And we may sometimes take up some of the unclean habits and unclean ways of the outside world. But we may have on a minor level this anxiety and taking shelter in things that are impermanent. It may be on a mild level. And let's understand, before we can look at the cure for this problem, what exactly is lust that has these kinds of symptoms, whether they're very mild symptoms, that we waste our time saying nasty things about other devotees instead of reading Bhagavatam, or whether they're very severe, like we go and, you know, distribute dead cows to starving people. What is this thing that pushes us to do this unclean work? Lust is basically the concept that I will be happy by enjoying my senses and my mind and being the master of the world. It's basically that concept. And it's that concept to such an extent that we no longer care about the consequences. So Krishna talks about in the end of the second chapter, the fall down sequence. He says, first you do what?
You meditate on the objects.
You meditate on objects of the senses. So, you know, you think about this new car, or you think about the car. And then, after thinking, you become attached. You start becoming convinced that if I get the car, or if I get this, or if I do that, it's not always a thing, that then I will feel satisfied. And that can happen, by the way, with thinking about almost anything. Almost anything. I mean, I'm sure many of you have heard that they have this new game where people run around and collect imaginary creatures. Right? Fortunately, some of them are in our temples, so people sometimes come to a Hare Krishna temple looking for these imaginary creatures. I heard that in London there's one at the lotus feet of the deity. So all these people come into the temple and come to see the deity. But people, they meditate on these just, you know, imaginary creatures, and they think that if I collect them, then I will become happy. By contemplating, they become attached to them. And so it can be something, it doesn't have to be a thing, like a car, or like a house, or a beautiful spouse, or something like that. It can be just something in virtual space. Isn't that odd? Don't you think that's rather odd? That you think if I collect something, I mean, all the computer games are like that, that people are trying to collect imaginary money and imaginary points, right? And you see people get very intense. If I collect this thing, then I'll become happy. So this is attachment. Now, when the attachment goes over into lust, which is the next step, something very peculiar happens. So if I'm just attached, it means I've made an equivalency in my mind that this activity, this thing, this relationship, this whatever, is going to satisfy me. But the contemplation, I'm just kind of checking it out. You understand? Now, if it just goes through your mind and it doesn't stay, it doesn't have that effect. But if you kind of keep it there, feed it, then you start believing, oh yeah, this is going to give me what I want. But once it transforms into lust, then you've decided, I'm so convinced that this is going to give me what I want that I don't care what price I pay for it. So attachment, you're not at that level yet. You're just like, you know, it would be nice if I had this, because if I could have this, and again, this is not always a thing. It may be a particular career, it may be a particular relationship, it may be a particular way of thinking. Yes? Particular mental ability or emotional ability. If I could, we were talking about that this morning. If I could have this, I would be happy. But lust is, I must have it. Do you understand the difference? If I said, you know, well, it would be really nice. I mean, if I could have that Mercedes-Benz, wow, my life would be great. See, if you're not on the attachment level, you don't think like that. You just think, oh, there's a Mercedes-Benz. On the attachment, it's like, that would make me happy. And lust is, I'm so convinced that it would make me happy that I don't care what price I have to pay for it. I'm willing to pay any price to get it. And so you've gone into a kind of madness, a kind of craziness. And that's why we do things we don't want to do. Do you all see the logic there? So I've said, okay, I want to spend whatever. I want to spend an hour every day reading Prabhupada's books. And instead, I go to sleep at night without having read Prabhupada's books even for 1 minute, and I've spent 4 hours completely wasting my time. So I sacrificed reading the scriptures for whatever I did to waste my time. Are you all following the steps here? That means something happened inside of me where this thing that I wasted my time on became so wrapped up with the idea that it would give me happiness that I sacrificed something very important to get it. Yes? And we see people out in the world regularly, and devotees too. We see people will sacrifice so many things. You know, for the sake of sexual lust, people will sacrifice their family, their career, their health, all their money. Happens all the time, doesn't it? Right? Or some kind of status or power. They'll sacrifice their ideals, their ethics, their morals. And frankly, we see even devotees do this kind of thing. We see devotees that run off with somebody else's wife, or they steal money from the temple or something like that. And then, of course, it doesn't really satisfy us because it's material. And then we become, what? What's the next step? Angry. We become angry. Either we can't get it, either we sacrifice and we don't get it anyway. Wow, you know, you give up your, what does Prabhupada say? You know, I lost my caste and I'm still hungry. You know that story? There was a brahmana who was very hungry, and he couldn't find, the brahmanas would only eat from the houses of brahmanas, but he couldn't find any brahmana's house. So he saw an untouchable's house, and he was so hungry, he said, you know, can I please come in and have something to eat? And he said, but you'll be contaminated coming in my house. He said, I don't care, I'm so hungry. He said, okay, but I actually don't have any food. So all he had was a little bit to eat, and he said, I've lost my caste, but I'm still hungry. So the problem with searching after lust is that it's like that. We lose our intelligence, and we're still not satisfied. Therefore, we become angry. Sometimes you sacrifice, 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 and you still don't get it. people sacrifice incredibly for their relationships, and sometimes the relationships fall apart anyway. One devotee friend I know was working to get her PhD, and usually there's a time limit. Usually it's like 7 years or 9 years in each university. So hers it was 7. And she was almost finished with her thesis. And then the head of her department had a stroke. And the other people on the committee didn't like what she was doing. And they said, we're not going to approve it. So that was it. She didn't get her degree. So, you know, you can work for 7 years, you can work for 20 years, and you never get it. Or you get it and you say, this isn't really what I wanted. You know, you work really, really hard to build a big house, and then you discover you don't actually like living in a big house. Or you work really hard and you get it and you love it, and then, you know, it burns down in a fire or something. I had when I was growing up, some of my friends had parents who worked really hard to build their own house, decorate it the way they wanted. And then 2 weeks after they moved in, the husband had a heart attack and they couldn't afford it. They had to sell it. So then we become angry. So the problem is, again, we meditate on some non-permanent something until we get to the point that we're so convinced that this non-permanent whatever, activity, thing, relationship, is going to satisfy us that we lose our intelligence. And we are willing to pay a price that's not reasonable for the thing. And that's what forces us to do the things that we regret. And we always regret paying that price because what we get is not worth it. But what do? Do we stop taking shelter of lust? No, we take shelter of lust again, but in another form. We say, you know, the strawberry ice cream didn't satisfy me, but pizza will satisfy me. This man didn't satisfy me. That man will satisfy me. No, that man will satisfy me. Or maybe another woman will satisfy me. Maybe this will. You know, we don't get out of the basic paradigm that the concept of becoming happy through non-permanent things is just simply wrong. It's all that's going to give us anxiety. So what is the cure? That is not given in this purport. So maybe we shouldn't even talk about it. The cure is to have the right shelter. Go back to the root. If we're unhappy, if we're dissatisfied, if we're angry, if we're upset, if we're frustrated, we're disappointed, we're bitter, we're hurt, go back to the root and get the right shelter. Those are all symptoms that I have the wrong shelter. I have the wrong concept of what's going to give me protection and security and happiness and satisfaction. That's the problem. The problem isn't the thing. The problem isn't the car. No, that's not really the problem. The problem is thinking that it's my shelter. So this should be our training, that only Krishna is my shelter. Only Krishna and service to Krishna is my shelter. Only that will bring me happiness. And what we really need to do is we need to be able to notice this lust when it just peeks over the horizon as contemplation. If we wait until we're under lust and anger, it's sort of too late. And then all you can do is lament. It's like if you wait until you drink the alcohol, until you realize I shouldn't drink the alcohol, you know, you're kind of stuck. Does this make sense to everybody? You have to recognize it from a distance. Just like people who are alcoholics, they're trained in these different organizations. Don't go where they're serving alcohol. Don't put yourself in a situation where you're likely to drink. See it from a distance. So we also need to do that. We need to become observers of our own mind, which we really already are. We need to wake up and be observers of our own mind, observers of our own thoughts, observers of our own emotions, observers of our own desires. We need to be able to distinguish between the impermanent and the permanent, what is illusion and what is Krishna. That's not always so easy to do. And Krishna had a son named Prajumna. This Prajumna is also Kamadev. Well, here we have Kama, yes? He is the deva of Kama. And who did he look very much like?
Krishna.
In fact, he looked so much like Krishna that his stepmothers couldn't tell the difference at first. His real mother could, but his stepmothers couldn't. They confused Krishna and Kamadev. So it's not always so easy to distinguish what is Krishna and what is illusion. They can look very much alike. So we need to have developed this discrimination to be able to tell from a long way away, oh, that's permanent and that's impermanent. And those that are impermanent, not contemplate them as objects of satisfaction. We might contemplate something as an object of service. But not as an object of material satisfaction. Because as soon as we start contemplating any non-permanent thing as an object of material satisfaction, we are taking the first steps to taking shelter of loss, which will always bring us to a platform of regret. So how do we do that? How do we distinguish the permanent from the impermanent? And how do we notice illusion and impermanence from far enough away that it never takes us over? This, my dear friends, is supposed to be the result of our contemplative practice. If you look at any religious or spiritual tradition that engages in some kind of deep process of prayer and meditation and contemplation, they will all tell you that one of the results is that you can perceive your thoughts and emotions as an observer, and you can perceive them before they take you over and control. That is what is supposed to happen to us as well. Not too long ago, I met a gentleman who's one of the world leaders in the Catholic tradition as far as a teacher of Catholicism. And he's become a secret Hare Krishna. Not secret to the devotees, but secret to his in Catholicism. And he told me that one of the main reasons that he took up Krishna consciousness was that he had never experienced any spiritual practice that was as powerful as chanting Hare Krishna. He said that he found that chanting had such a dramatic effect at purifying him of his material desires and clearing his consciousness that he thought, this is definitely the practice that I want to take. So one way we can say whether or not we're doing our chanting and our meditation correctly is it having this effect on us? Are we able to become, to realize, we already are, to realize that we are the observer? That the inclinations of the mind and the senses are not ours? Are we able to distinguish reality from illusion? And are we able to distinguish it before we get to the point that we're swept up in it and acting on it? Well, this should be one test of, are we really deeply chanting? Or are we chanting as some kind of external, superficial ritual? A quote I've heard not long ago that's become one of my favorite quotes is Prabhupada said, if you're chanting Hare Krishna and thinking about material things, then it is useless. And then he has this long pause. He said, or it will take a long time. He said, when you're chanting, can't you remember Krishna's instructions in the Bhagavad Gita? He said, or why are you reading Krishna book? He said, you should be able to remember how Krishna's killing a demon and the boys are encouraging him with claps. He says, otherwise you're negligent in your practice. So we are meant to go deeply, particularly in our japa. Prabhupada says the most important instruction of a spiritual master is to chant 16 rounds. So particularly in our japa, it's supposed to be a very meditative, contemplative practice that is supposed to chaita darpan marjanam. It's supposed to clean the mirror of the heart. Same with kirtan. You know, sometimes I've gone to a kirtan festival where you see the devotees, especially if they've paid money for it. You know, if they've paid 200 euros to go to the kirtan weekend. Then they're very focused. Right? Have you ever experienced that? They're really, really, really focused. And everyone... Can we try it again? Is it safe? Then, and everyone in the whole kirtan hall has this intense, beautiful focus on the chanting. And when it's like that, then really amazing things happen in people's consciousness. But I've also seen many times we just see kirtan as some kind of a time filler. You know, where the program hasn't really started, they're just doing kirtan. You know, I'll wait till the kirtan's over and then I'll go in. Kirtan's just a time kind of to space out and check your phone and think about other things until the real thing starts. And then we can find that we may be going on for year after year after year and decade after decade after decade, and we're still taking shelter of lust. Maybe not so bad as these demons here, but in some way or another. So particularly those practices of kirtan and japa. Of course, everything we're doing, our practice of deity worship, our practice of studying the scriptures, everything we're doing is meant to bring us to that state. But particularly the holy name is supposed to clear our consciousness. And that will be the effect that we'll find, that it's harder and harder and harder for us to become overwhelmed by lust. It's harder for us to be surprised that the lust has to take ever more subtle and difficult disguises to fool us, because we're able to recognize it in most of its forms. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Yes?
Can we come to the point with lust and anger, that there is no way out with it.
There is no
way out. Like, that we come so deeply that there is no any methods
that will take us out. Yes and no. On the platform, Krishna does say in this chapter that those who get deeply into this lust and anger, he puts them into lower species again and again and again, where it's very difficult for them to get out. But any soul will eventually come back to a human form. In the human form, there's some kind of religion in society. And any time you have a contact with the Lord, it is possible to get out. So that opportunity keeps being offered to the soul, at least periodically.
Because for me, for example, I'm coming here for about 3 years now, but some things just stay the same. There is no progression. Like, for the things which I liked 3 years ago, and I still like them today. So,
I think what most of us see is that in taking up Krishna consciousness, so I can ask everybody. So all of you here, do you have some things about Krishna consciousness that you find really, really easy? Who has something Krishna consciousness you find super easy, just like breathing? Okay. And what do you find for the things in Krishna consciousness? Kind of medium. You know, they're pretty easy, but you have to make some effort. And who do you have some things in Krishna consciousness that are just extremely hard and you've just been struggling with them for years? So, and by the way, those are going to be different from... So if we were to ask, I'm not going to do that, but if we were to ask people here to make a list, what are the things you find so easy that you don't even notice you're doing them anymore? what are the things that are, you know, they're pretty easy, but you have to make an effort. And what are the things that are just really, really hard? You'll find that one person's list of really, really hard is another person's list of super easy. Which is why we sometimes judge each other very harshly. You know, that what I find super easy for someone else, maybe they've been struggling with it for 20 years. And they just can't seem to make any progress at all. But it works the other way, you know, the thing that I'm struggling with, they might find super easy. So we all have some very deep-rooted, specific attachments. And the reason we don't make progress with those is that we're taking shelter of them. And we're very afraid that if we give up their shelter, that we'll suffer in some way. So our fear and attachment to them is so strong, we just hold on to them like anything. They will go. They will go. Best to focus on the successes. Don't give that much attention to the failures. Give most of the attention to the successes. And the other things will come, but we just see practically. Each of us has certain things that are seem to be really, really, really difficult. Really deep-rooted things. Some of us may not even be aware of those when we first come to Krishna consciousness. We may not even see them as a problem. And after chanting for a while, you start to see, oh, I really have a problem with this. And it's really, really deep. It is possible. I mean, I was just, again, watching a video of Prabhupada the other day where he said, you know, it's just a matter of a moment. If you really surrender to Krishna, it's a matter of a moment. Most of us are not willing to really surrender to Krishna in a matter of a moment. If you want to see what's blocking you, you can always ask and they'll show you what's blocking you. Maybe surprised. I remember one time I was at our temple in Delhi in India, at the restaurant there, talking with another devotee who was quoting the Bhaktisiddhanta says, and Srila Prabhupada says, that Krishna is a transcendental autocrat. And as soon as he said the word autocrat, everything in me just rose up in rebellion. It's like I had this wave of rebellion. You know what an autocrat is? So auto means self. Krat has to do with governments, like a dictator. I always say someone's an autocrat, like a dictator. They do whatever they want. That word is very politically charged in the world today, right? We all want to have democracies and we don't want to have any dictator. Krishna is the transcendental dictator. I didn't care about the word transcendental. That didn't change anything for me. And it was this instant. As soon as he said Krishna is a transcendental autocrat, it was an instant, spontaneous, not spontaneous love. It was instant, spontaneous rebellion. And I was so shocked. I was like, wow. I really don't want to surrender to Krishna. It's really interesting. That's the reality. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you can ask Krishna, if there's something that's been an ongoing problem, you can say, what's really going on here? And you may be surprised to see what's really going on there. You know, the more that you take up, as again, in a very deep, contemplative, absorbed way, the practices of japa and kirtan particularly, but everything, again, deity worship, reading, all of our practices, the more you'll start to see what you're holding on to. Yes? Has everyone had this experience? You see things very clearly. And someone will say something about surrender to Krishna, and something in you goes, oh! No! So outside, you may, yeah, I want to surrender. But inside, you go, no way. Before you get it, you can't surrender anything. So when we notice those sort of things, then we see, well, this is why I'm having so much difficulty with this or that other external behavior. That was a very thoughtful question. Somebody else? Yes?
How can I change my mind? check myself, am I taking shelter to Krishna or to Maya? Because sometimes I think, oh, I'm doing service for Krishna, but actually this is...
Yeah, we're going to talk about this with Manushiksha, especially verse 6. Are you coming? Especially verse 6, we will talk about. But also we'll be talking about that next Sunday for the Sunday feast in a shortened form. When does Maya masquerade as Krishna? How does Maya masquerade as Krishna? Rupa Goswami talks about this, about leaves that look like bhakti. So this is what I mean with the ability to discern what is Krishna and what is Maya. Like when I say very far away, in other words, when it's before you've really done anything about it, or just the first time I tried to go grow flowers, I had no experience with growing flowers, so I bought all these flower seeds and I just got the ground ready and then I put the seeds anywhere, and very soon the whole area was covered with little green things. And being completely, absolutely, totally inexperienced, I had no way of telling which of the little green things were marigolds and zinnias and which of the little green things were weeds. I had to wait until they got big enough. You understand? And then, of course, it was a mess. And once I became a little bit more experienced gardener, then I could distinguish, oh, I know you. You're a marigold. I was just at a temple that had all these beautiful tulsi plants. But in the pots, all these little weeds were growing. And I wonder if these people think they're tulsis. I wonder if they can't recognize the difference between tulsi and something else. So what gives us the ability to recognize the difference between a flower and a weed when it's really, really, really small? The clearing of the consciousness that comes through very focused, deep spiritual practice. And you should be getting better and better at that. So it should be that Maya has to take increasingly subtle and disguised forms in order to fool you. Do you understand? If you're still being fooled by the same things you were fooled by 2 years ago and 5 years ago, then you need to go more deeper in your practice. Because that's definitely one of the effects. I mean, Krishna talks about this a little later in Bhagavad Gita. How the mode of goodness, you can see what's to be done and what's not to be done, what's binding, what's liberating. That's just the mode of goodness. That's not even bhakti. And right at the beginning of the Bhagavatam, to distinguish reality from illusion. But I mean, until we're completely pure, we'll still be fooled by something. As I said, that's a lot about what Manushiksha is about, especially verses 4, 5, 6, 7. How we become fooled by things. And Raghunath Das Goswami goes more and more and more subtle as to what can appear to us to be spiritual and actually is not. And that's quite a lot of what Tirtha Prabhupada talking about in the purport, people who make up their own religion, their own vows, and their own honor in society. They're really nasty things, but they're thinking, oh yeah, this is a great thing. I mean, once you get into something, you can tap, there are certain symptoms. The symptoms of whether or not you're taking shelter of Krishna is very much from Bhagavad Gita, 9th chapter, where Krishna says, Raja Vija Raja Gunya Bhavi Chami Dhutamam Prachak Shavagamam Dhammam Susukam Kartamam. So you get full of knowledge, full of wisdom, kind of. You're full of wisdom, understanding. And Raja Gunya, very secretive. You really understand the essence of things. Pavitram, you feel purified, you feel clean. Dharma, it's very real, it's a very authentic experience. Susupam's full of happiness. So when you take shelter of Krishna, you feel those subjective experiences rather than here just anxiety and hankering and lamentation. And then, of course, is it in the scripture? Is it taught by the sadhus? Is it given by guru? You know, is it taught in the shastras that if you take shelter of Krishna, you go into some place and kill a bunch of people? You know, so that's not taking shelter of Krishna. So those are some pretty simple ways. Is it in the scriptures? Is it taught by the saints? Is it taught by the guru? Does it bring me wisdom? Does it bring me purification? Does it bring me joy? Does it bring me authenticity? Anything else? Is that all right? Okay, thank you very much. You can profile, Keith.